I'm Kurt Anderson, and you are listening to Studio 360. So this is the golden age of television. Actually, it's the golden age of the anti-hero on television, in particular, the white middle-aged male anti-hero. Don Draper, Walter White, Tony Soprano, totally irredeemable characters who we root for anyhow. Terry Winter knows something about charismatic sociopaths. He wrote a couple of dozen episodes of The Sopranos. Then he created the terrific gangster series Boardwalk Empire, set during Prohibition. And he wrote Martin Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street. His new series on HBO is called Vinyl. And for it, he created Richie Finestra, a drug-addled, financially stressed, middle-aged record mogul.
Now, assume an artist gets paid a dollar for every record sold, less recoupable expenses. So, sell a million records, that's $1 million. Not bad, right? But there's that word, recoupable.
That's Bobby Cannavale as Richie Finestra.
That means that no matter how many records they sell, the actual cost of producing that record always comes out of the artist's end. Physically manufacturing the record, touring costs, studio space, marketing, packaging. If a drummer drinks a Pepsi in the middle of recording that album, believe me, he's paying for it at a 700% markup. We really don't have any downside.
No. No, we practically break even on all the flops. But the hits, that's where we cash in big.
That is Ray Romano there at the end, who also stars in Vinyl. So Richie is having an existential crisis, and in the first episode alone, he smashes an iconic guitar, hoovers up cocaine, commits business fraud, and very much worse, all dreamed up by Terry Winter. Good to have you here, sir.
Hi, happy to be here.
So tell me about the germ for Vinyl. Where did it come from, and where do Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger come in?
The germ of this started well before I got involved. In 1996, Mick Jagger approached Martin Scorsese, I believe in London, and pitched him on the idea of doing a version of, say, the movie Casino set in the world of rock and roll.
Huh. So really, Mick is not just in like a decorative attachment?
Not at all. No, this started with him, and he said, let's do this sweeping epic set in the world of rock and roll. And their idea was to follow one guy who ultimately became Richie Finestra. It was a record executive, just this 19-year-old kid, say in 1959, his first job in the record business, and then stay with that character over the course of the next three or four decades. So you started in the doo-wop era, follow him through the British invasion into the 70s and stadium rock into new wave, punk, disco, hip-hop, all the way through gangster rap.
It was to be a feature?
It was to be a feature, huh. Yeah. And it was going to be a big Martin Scorsese epic. In 2007, they were still working on it. This is 11 years later. I had just written the pilot episode of Boardwalk Empire, and I just wrote Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese he called me up and said, listen, I have this other thing. It's this movie set in the world of rock and roll. I'm doing it with Mick Jagger. Do you think you'd be interested in something like that? So
Mick Jagger invented this series. Is he involved in an ongoing way? Does he hang around the set? Does he read scripts? How does that work?
He is involved very much so. He and Martin Scorsese together are very, very hands-on here. I mean, Mick, you know, due to his touring schedule, is often not physically present.
Oh, yeah. He's in a band.
Yeah. He's got a little side gig he does. But he actually sat in with us in the writer's room a couple of days, which was pretty incredible for me and my writers. And when Mick had gotten there, he got me on the side and said, what's going to happen in there? And I said, well, it's going to take about 15 minutes before people adjust to the fact that Mick Jagger
at least
is sitting across from them. And once they do, we just start to talk. It's just really just storytelling and riffing. And at that point, we were talking about the idea of Richie and Devin, his wife, living in suburbia and kind of being alienated there. And that, you know, again, on paper, that's what you do when you're successful. You move out and get a big house in the suburbs. And then, of course, if you're a city person, that might not be the best thing. And, you know, within a few minutes, Mick started sharing stories about, you know, himself and the idea that, you know, he had a big country estate outside of London and, you know, sitting out there and feeling kind of bored and thinking, you know, I thought this is what I was supposed to do. And he really wanted to get back to the city. And he just became one of the other writers telling stories and laughing. And it was just really, really easy and fun and natural.
Can I look at the tapes of those?
We don't tape anything. Otherwise, people would never say anything revealing.
And did he make you hire his kid?
Not at all.
Who was a not insignificant actor in the show?
No, I mean Marty cast the pilot, and from what I understand, Mick said, you know, when the part called for a, you know, young punk rock singer, Mick said, "Look, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that my son James is in a punk rock band."
Oh, really? That said, so that's real?
Oh, yeah, totally. He said, "If you'll see him, that'd be great." No pressure whatsoever. James came in, met with Marty, read with Juno Temple, and he's absolutely terrific. You know, he could not be better on the show. He is that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's
really? He's a jerk?
He's that punk rock guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There is also beautiful period production design, and it's a period that I lived through, so I love it all the more for that reason. There is one particularly amazing piece, which is the ravaged graffiti-covered subway cars and subway station, New York subways aren't like that anymore.
No.
So did you – and that must have been a very expensive ruin to create.
That was created digitally. That done by our incredible visual effects supervisor, Leslie Robeson Foster.
Wow, that's impressive in that case.
That train was pristine.
And the station.
And the station as well.
Wow.
And that's all done with visual effects. Well, and that's the interesting thing. I mean, usually you use visual effects to make things look better.
Yes.
On our show, we needed it to make buildings look decrepit. And
No, it made me laugh. It made me want to show that scene to my children.
Yeah.
This was really the way it was.
Absolutely. I remember back then, if a clean train would show up, people would look at each other and go, what's happening?
Before you were a creator of TV shows and screenwriter and a writer, you were a New York lawyer.
Yes.
Was there a precipitating event that made you chuck that?
I should not have been in law school in the first place. Law school for me was a way of avoiding what I really wanted to do and was too scared to do, which was be a TV writer.
Oh, you knew that already?
Deep in my heart, I did, yeah. And I just didn't have the balls to pursue it. It was just something that I just couldn't imagine. I mean, you didn't know anybody in Brooklyn growing up in the 70s who had anything to do with the film business. And it just seemed so ludicrous to even dream about. It's funny, a good friend of mine, when we were in law school together, we were sharing an apartment and we were watching TV one night, and he said, you know, if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? Now, you would hope that two people in law school, the answer would be a lawyer. But even then, we were planning on doing something else. And I said, well, very tentatively, I don't know, I guess I'd be like a writer for David Letterman or something. And he said, no, something realistic. And I remember thinking, I can't even dream about this. It's not even a realistic fantasy. So it was really hard for me to finally – confronted out loud. And ultimately what happened is I just got so unhappy after a couple of years of practicing law, and I just knew it wasn't for me. I just didn't want to go to work anymore. And I just finally one day just said, I have to do this.
And you wrote for Flipper.
You wrote for
Xena Warrior Princess.
My standards were very high. In order for me to take a job, you had to say, do you want this job?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I would
yeah.
say, yes, I
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't believe people were paying me to write. And I wasn't choosing jobs based on what they were. It was like I couldn't believe that somebody would pay me to write any script. And Flipper sounded great and Xena sounded great, and they were.
And it wasn't that long, 5 or 6 years, I guess, before Sopranos came along.
My agent at the time sent me a VHS tape and said, I want you to watch this pilot. It's called The Sopranos. And, of course, I thought, opera, great. Why me?
Yeah.
He said, just watch it. And I don't even think I finished it, and I called him back. I said, you have got to get me on this show. I knew guys like that. I actually worked for a butcher shop in Brooklyn that was owned by Paul Castellano when I was a teenager.
Huh.
And
who was, listeners, a famous gangster.
Yeah, the head of the Gambino crime family. And, I just sort of by osmosis sort of, you know, knew how those guys talked and acted and just understood that world. And I was a huge fan of, you know, mob movies and read all the books and all that stuff. So
have you – you've written screenplays. You wrote The Wolf of Wall Street. But do you think of yourself as happier, better, whatever-er at – television series writing, making than feature film writing?
I really like the idea of telling a long story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great luxury to live with characters over the course of dozens of episodes and to create a universe and a backstory and worlds. And it's really satisfying. Films are writing a film is much more challenging. It's sort of, you know, the greatest hits of that person's life. I always talk about the Al Capone. You know, every movie you've seen of Al Capone is always the cigar chomping guy at the height of his power. And we had such a luxury on Boardwalk Empire to start with the Al Capone Capone nobody knew, the chubby kid driving the other guy's car, and to go home with Al Capone. And, you know, those scenes with Al Capone and his deaf son, if you had that in your movie, they'd say, well, that has to go. We got to get to the machine gun.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that's so much more interesting.
Totally. So you've shot the entire season before anybody has seen one.
Right.
Was that true of Boardwalk Empire as well?
Yeah. And that's an enormous luxury as a storyteller to have the whole piece done and to see it. And, you know, on occasion you'd go back and backfill in a scene or a moment or tweak something.
It's like writing a novel.
Yeah, which is great.
And you don't have to, as happens, as you know better than I, in television, regular series television all the time, writers and producers respond to how the audience is reacting to characters.
Right.
Do you miss that, or is it good not to have to?
Oh, I don't want that at all.
To hell with the audience and what they want.
Yeah, not so much that as it is. You know, somebody's got to be in charge of telling the story, and I'm going to do that, and I hope you like it.
Yes.
You know, otherwise, I mean, I'm always mystified when I read about showrunners who tweet with the audience, and the audience tells them what they want to see, and then they do it, and it's just like a puppet show or something, and I'm not sure who's steering that ship.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's like I really truly hope audiences like what I'm doing, and we all do. But, you know, and I guess if they don't, I won't have a job very long.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to let the audience dictate what the story should be. Otherwise, it's a completely different thing.
Hear, hear. and all I know is that with so much to watch today that's good or might be good or is great, my wife and I watched this 2-hour pilot yesterday, and we both said, so I guess we got to add this to the menu too. So that's a measure of something.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry to impose on you for 10 more hours, but I hope you'll be happy. I think you will.
Thanks. I enjoyed it a lot. Terry Winter, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great being here.
Vinyl debuts on HBO on February 14th.